a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Professor Martha C. Nussbaum of the University of Chicago presents the 2007-2008 Sherrill Lecture, which brings distinguished visitors with special expertise in international law and international relations to Yale Law School. Professor Nussbaum uses India as an example of her theories about the impact of religious nationalism on democratic values.
For many years, I've done development work with women's groups in India, and it has been the focus of my analysis of human capability. So as political events unfolded there, I felt drawn to write about them, and I hope that this illuminates some more general issues about democracy, and that's what I'm going to try to do today. On February 27th, 2002, the Sabarmati express train arrived in the station of Godhra in the Indian state of Gujarat, bearing a large group of Hindu pilgrims who were returning from a pilgrimage to the alleged birthplace of the god Rama at Ayodhya, where some years earlier, angry Hindu mobs had destroyed the Babri Mosque, which they claim is on top of the remains of Rama's birthplace. This pilgrimage, like many others in recent times, aimed at forcibly constructing a temple over the disputed site, and the mood of the returning passengers, frustrated in their aims by the government and the courts, was angry. When the train stopped at the Godhra station, passengers got into arguments with Muslim vendors and passengers. At least one Muslim vendor was beaten up when he refused to say, "Jai Shri Ram," Hail Ram, and a young Muslim girl narrowly escaped forcible abduction. As the train left the station, stones were thrown at it, apparently by Muslims. 15 minutes later, one car of the train erupted in flames. 58 men, women, and children died in the fire. Most of the dead were Hindus. Because the area adjacent to the tracks where the train had come to a halt was an area of Muslim dwellings, and because a Muslim mob had gathered in the region to protest the treatment of Muslims on the station platform, blame was immediately put on Muslims. Many people were arrested, and some of these are still in detention today, 5 years later, without charge, despite the fact that two independent inquiries into the event have established through careful sifting of the forensic evidence that the fire was most probably a tragic accident caused by combustion from cook stoves carried on by the passengers and stored under the seats of the train. In the days that followed, wave upon wave of violence swept through the state. The attackers were Hindus, many of them highly politicized, shouting Hindu right-wing slogans such as Jai Shri Ram, which of course is a religious invocation that's been wrenched away from its original devotional and peaceful meaning, along with things like kill, destroy, slaughter. There's copious evidence that the violent retaliation was planned by Hindu extremist organizations before the precipitating event, and actually after I wrote that sentence just 2 weeks ago, a new expose by the Indian journal Tehelka has chillingly brought a lot new evidence to light. With hidden cameras, they have taped a lot of Hindu right-wing people, including officers of the law who take pride in having planned and perpetrated some of this violence. So no one was spared. Young children were burned along with their families. Particularly striking was the number of women who were raped, mutilated, and in some cases tortured with large metal objects and then set on fire. Over the course of several weeks, approximately 2,000 Muslims were killed. Most alarming was the total breakdown in the rule of law, not only at the local level, but also at the level of state government. Police were ordered not to stop the violence, and some egged it on. Gujarat's Chief Minister Narendra Modi rationalized and even encouraged the murders. He was later reelected on a platform that focused on religious hatred. Because evidence of his criminal activity is so overwhelming, he has been denied a visa to enter the United States. Meanwhile, the national government showed a culpable indifference. Prime Minister Vajpayee suggested that religious riots were inevitable whenever Muslims lived alongside Hindus, and that troublemaking Muslims were probably to blame. Leading politicians conveyed the message that government would treat the nation's citizens unequally. Some would receive the full protection of the law, and others would not. Prosecutions resulting from the riots have faced related problems, the bias of local judges, the intimidation and bribery of witnesses. While Americans have focused on the war on terror, Iraq, and the Middle East, democracy has been under siege in another part of the world. India, the most populous of all democracies, and a country whose constitution protects human rights even more comprehensively than our own, has been in crisis. Until May 2004, its parliamentary government was increasingly controlled by right-wing Hindu extremists who condone and in some cases actively support violence against minorities, particularly the Muslim minority. Many seek fundamental changes in India's pluralistic democracy. Despite their electoral loss, these political groups and the social organizations allied with them remain extremely powerful, and they still control state government in several states. Democracy and the rule of law have shown impressive strength and resilience, but the future is unclear. What's been happening in India is a serious threat to the future of democracy in the world. The fact that it hasn't fully made it onto the radar screen of most Americans is evidence, I think, of the way in which terrorism and the war in Iraq have distracted Americans from events and issues of fundamental significance. If we really want to understand the impact of religious nationalism on democratic values, India currently provides a deeply troubling example, and one without which any more general understanding of the phenomenon is dangerously incomplete. It also provides an example of how democracy can survive the assault of religious extremism. In May 2004, the voters of India went to the polls in very large numbers. The voter turnout is typically much higher than ours is. Contrary to all predictions, they gave the Hindu right a resounding defeat. Because even exit polls taken in cities and towns did not predict this result, it's clear that impoverished rural voters played a major role in giving India a new government. In this talk, I want to use the case of Gujarat as a lens through which to conduct a critical examination of the influential thesis of the so-called clash of civilizations, made famous by Samuel P. Huntington, but of course believed, I think, in some form by many people who don't even really know of Huntington's book. Huntington's picture of the world as riven between democratic Western values and an aggressive Muslim monolith does nothing to help us understand today's India, where the violent values of the Hindu right are imports from European fascism of the 1930s, and where the second largest Muslim population in the world lives at peace despite severe poverty and other inequalities. So through a study of this case, I want to argue that the real clash of civilizations is not the clash between Islam and the West, but instead a clash within virtually all modern nations, between people who are prepared to live with people who differ on terms of equal respect, and those who seek the protection of homogeneity and the domination of a single, pure religious and ethnic tradition. At a deeper level, my thesis is really the Gandhian thesis that the real clash of civilizations is a clash inside the individual self, between the urge to dominate and defile the other, and a willingness to live respectfully on terms of compassion and equality with all the vulnerability that such a life entails. This argument about India will also suggest a way to see America, which is also torn between two different pictures of itself. One picture shows America and Americans as good and pure, its enemies as an external axis of evil. The other picture, the fruit of internal self-criticism, shows America to itself as complex and flawed, torn between forces bent on control and hierarchy and forces that promote democratic equality. At a deeper level, what I've called the Gandhian level, my internal clash picture shows Americans to themselves as people, each of whom is capable of both respect and aggression, of both democratic mutuality and anxious domination. As George Kennan wrote after the Second World War, "I wish I could believe that the human impulses which give rise to the nightmares of totalitarianism were ones which Providence had allocated only to other peoples and to which the American people had been graciously left immune. Unfortunately, I know this is not true. The fact of the matter is that there's a little bit of the totalitarian buried somewhere way down deep in each and every one of us." So, according to Huntington's thesis, each civilization has its own rather unitary, distinctive view of life, and Hinduism counts as a distinct civilization, and it is the civilization of India. If we investigate the history of the Hindu right, however, we see a very different story. Traditional Hinduism was decentralized, plural, and highly tolerant. So much so that the vision of a unitary, pure Hinduism that could provide the new nation with an aggressive ideology of homogeneity could not be found in India at all. The founders of the Hindu right had to import it from Europe. Today, European fascism is seated right at the heart of what parades, in some quarters at least, as Hindu civilization. The Hindu right's view of history is a simple one, and like all simple tales, it's largely a construction, but its importance to the movement may be seen by the intensity with which its members go after scholars, including particularly scholars in the US, who present a more nuanced and accurate view, not only by strident public critiques, but by organized campaigns of threat and intimidation, culminating in at least one case in physical violence. Here's how the story goes. Once there lived in the Indus Valley a pure and peaceful people. They spoke Vedic Sanskrit, language revealed as that of the gods when the immortal Vedas were given to humanity. They had a rich material culture, well suited to sustain their prosperous life. Despite their peaceful temper, they were also well prepared for war. They had chariots and even horses. There are a lot of linguistic arguments that are turned on the question about the horse, which we could get into later. Their realm was vast, stretching from Kashmir in the north to Sri Lanka or Ceylon in the south. And yet they saw unity and solidarity in their shared ways of life, calling themselves Hindus and their shared land Hindustan. No class divisions troubled them, nor was caste a painful source of division. The condition of women was excellent. This peaceful condition went on for centuries, although from time to time marauders made their appearance at this people's doorstep, for example, the Huns. They were quickly dispatched because this people was warlike and aggressive when it needed to be, and its strength was feared far and wide. Suddenly, unprovoked, invading Muslims put an end to all that. The early medieval period saw brief incursions by Muslims bent on the destruction of Hindu temples. These, however, proved short-lived. Disaster struck with a heavier hand, however, when Babur swept through the north of India early in the 16th century, vandalizing Hindu temples, stealing sacred objects, building mosques over temple ruins. For 200 years, Hindus lived at the mercy of the marauders until the Maharashtrian hero Shivaji rose up against the aliens in the 18th century and drove them back, restoring the Hindu kingdom. His success, however, was all too brief. Soon, the British East India Company and then the British themselves took up where Babur and his progeny had left off, imposing a tyranny upon Hindustan and her people. In short, despite the flawless excellence of indigenous Hindu culture, the men of Hindustan have lived for centuries in a humiliated condition. They can recover pride in themselves only by concerted aggression against alien elements in their midst. If they rise to the occasion, they can restore the original bliss, the time when Rama ruled the world with his blessings. What is wrong with this picture? Well, for a start, the people who spoke Sanskrit almost certainly migrated into the subcontinent from outside, finding indigenous people there, and quite probably the ancestors of the Dravidian peoples of South India. Hindus are no more indigenous than Muslims. Second, it leaves out problems in early Hindu society. The problem of caste, which both Gandhi and Rabindranath Tagore took to be the central problem facing the new nation, and obvious problems of class and gender inequality. When historians point to evidence of these things, they call them Marxists, as if that label by itself invalidated the arguments. Third, it leaves out the tremendous regional differences within Hinduism and hostilities and aggressions sometimes associated with these. I mean, a lot of temples were vandalized, in fact, by rival Hindu factions. Fourth, it omits evidence of peaceful coexistence and syncretism between Hindus and Muslims for a good deal of the Mughal Empire, including Akbar's well-known policies of religious pluralism. Muslims have to be nothing but bad and aggressive. In the Hindu right version of history, a persistent theme is that of humiliated masculinity. According to the received story, Hindus have been subordinated for centuries and their masculinity insulted, in part because they have not been willing to be warlike and aggressive enough. Even when the violence of the conquerors is decried, Hindu males are encouraged to emulate that aggressive and warlike demeanor. Rabindranath Tagore, deeply perceptive here as always, represents his Hindu nationalist anti-hero in his 1916 novel, The Home and the World, as wishing he could seize the woman he desires by force, but he finds himself unable to do that. He then blames this inability on his Hindu heritage and wishes for a different nature. He says that there are two different sorts of music one might hear in one's head, the sound of the Hindu flute and the sound of the British military band. And he wishes that he could hear in his blood the British military band rather than that disturbingly non-aggressive flute. The two leading ideologues of the Hindu right, who in different ways responded to the call for a warlike Hindu masculinity, are V.D. Savarkar, a freedom fighter who spent years in a British prison in the Andaman Islands, and who may have been a co-conspirator in the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, and M.S. Gawarkar, a guru-like figure who was not involved in the independence struggle and who quietly, behind the scenes, built up the organization now known as the RSS, which means National Corps of Volunteers. That's now the leading social organization of the Hindu right. Savarkar's book, Hindutva, Who is a Hindu, 1923, undertakes to define the essence of Hinduism, or Hindu-ness, for the new nation. His definition is exclusionary, emphasizing cultural homogeneity and the need to use force to ensure the supremacy of Hindus. For reasons of time, however, I'm going to focus only on Gawarkar's book, We or Our Nationhood Defined, 1939. Some of the remarks I'm about to quote are embarrassing to Hindus on the right today, and members of the Hindu right hasten to assure one that Gawarkar knew nothing about the Holocaust and withdrew the offending statements in editions of the book published after the war. But 1939, the year of the work's initial publication, was still after the Nuremberg Laws, 1935, and Kristallnacht, 1938. Moreover, my own copy of the fourth edition, published in 1947, still contains the statements as I shall quote them here. Writing during the independence struggle, Gawarkar sees his task as that of describing the unity of the new nation. He announces that most Indians' ideas about nationhood are mistaken. Quote, they are not in conformity with those of the Western political scientists. It is but proper, therefore, at this stage to understand what the Western scholars state as the universal nation idea and correct ourselves. With this end in view, we shall now proceed with stating and analyzing the world's accepted nation concept, end quote. So notice, the unselfconscious deference to European scholarship is what the world thinks. Gawarkar now turns to English dictionaries and to British and German political science. The five elements he finds repeated as hallmarks of national unity are geography, race, religion, culture, and language. He examines each of these in turn and then analyzes several nations to see to what extent they embody the desired unity. Germany impresses him especially for the way in which it has managed to bring, quote, under one sway the whole of the territory, end quote, that was originally held by the Germani but that had been parceled out under different regimes. Turning to race, he observes, quote, German race pride has now become the topic of the day. To keep up the purity of the race and its culture, Germany shocked the world by her purging the country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifested here. Germany has also shown how well nigh impossible it is for races and cultures having differences going to the root to be assimilated into one united whole, a good lesson for us in Hindustan to learn and profit by. In the end, Gawarkar's vision of India's unity is not exactly that of Nazi Germany. He's not very concerned with purity of blood, and really he can't be because a large proportion of the Muslims and Christians in India are converts. He's far more concerned with the group's desire to merge into the dominant whole. Groups who fall outside the fivefold definition of national unity, he concludes, can, quote, have no place in the national life unless they abandon their differences and completely merge themselves in the national race, end quote. Unlike Hitler, Gawarkar would probably be perfectly happy with the conduct of many German Jews who converted to Christianity and assimilated their lifestyle to the dominant German lifestyle. Nonetheless, he's firmly against the civic equality of any people who retain their religious and ethnic distinctiveness, refusing to merge into the dominant Hindu whole. He speaks approvingly of the idea that people who refuse to assimilate will lose their civil rights. And here's the way in which he applies his ruminations about the old nations to the case of India. There are only two courses open to the foreign elements, by which he means Muslims and Christians, either to merge themselves in the national race and adopt its culture, or to live at the sweet will of the national race. That is the only logical and correct solution. That alone keeps the national life healthy and undisturbed. That alone keeps the nation safe from the danger of a cancer developing into its body politic of the creation of a state within the state. From this standpoint, sanctioned by the experiences of shrewd old nations, the non-Hindu peoples in Hindustan must either adopt the Hindu culture and language, must learn to respect and hold in reverence Hindu religion, must entertain no idea but that of glorification of the Hindu race and culture, i.e., they must not only give up their attitude of intolerance and ungratefulness towards this land and its age-long traditions, but must also cultivate the positive attitude of love and devotion instead. In one word, they must cease to be foreigners, or they may stay in the country, wholly subordinated to the Hindu nation, claiming nothing, deserving no privileges, not even citizens' rights. There is, at least should be, no other course for them to adopt. Now, at this time, the RSS was a cultural movement without a distinct political arm. It disavowed connection with the more overtly political group called the Hindu Mahasabha, which later did propose that Muslims and Christians would lose all civil rights in the new nation. Clearly, however, that is Galwarkar's program too, and we shouldn't doubt that such aims lie beneath the modern political arm of the RSS, the party that's known as the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party. At the time of independence, such ideas of Hindu supremacy did not prevail. Nehru and Gandhi insisted not only on equal rights for all citizens, but also on the most stringent protections for religious freedom in the new constitution. Gandhi always pointedly included Muslims at the very heart of his movement, and a devout Muslim named Maulana Azad was not only one of his and Nehru's most trusted advisors, he was the person to whom Gandhi turned to break his fast unto death, accepting food at his hand, a very pointed assault on traditions of purity and pollution. Gandhi's ideas, however, never went uncontested. On January 30th, 1948, Mahatma Gandhi was shot at point-blank range by Nathuram Godse, member of the Hindu Mahasabha and a former member of the RSS. Godse, who edited a newspaper called Hindu Rashtra, meaning Hindu Nation, had left the RSS because it seemed to him not political enough. The Mahasabha, a political party, was far more congenial. As was shown by a letter written by Godse to Savarkar in 1938 and submitted to the trial court, Godse had a long relationship with Savarkar, whom he revered. And this is how the letter goes. Since the time you were released from your internment at Ratnagiri, a divine fire has kindled in the minds of those groups who profess that Hindustan is for the Hindus, end quote. He speaks of using the Hindu Mahasabha to build a national volunteer army, drawing on the resources of the RSS, where he was then a leading local organizer. At his sentencing on November 8, 1949, Godse, who of course had immediately confessed, read a long book-length statement of self-explanation justifying the assassination for posterity. Although the statement was not permitted publication at the time, it has long since leaked out, and by now it's very, very much in the public domain. Translations into Indian languages began appearing almost immediately, and in 1977, the full text of the original was published by Godse's brother under the polite title, May It Please Your Honor. And so, today, the statement is widely available on the internet, where Godse is something of a hero on Hindu right-wing websites, and actually there's one website entirely devoted to glorifying him. It's www.naturamgodse.com, if you want to look it up, and he's revered there as the true patriot and the true Indian. This website also contains the full text of a Marathi language play written recently, glorifying Godse, a play that has been banned in India. Godse's self-justification, like the historical accounts of Savarkar and Galwarkar, sees recent events against the backdrop of centuries of Muslim tyranny, to use his words, punctuated by the heroic resistance of Shivaji. Like Savarkar, he describes his goal as that of creating a strong, proud India that can throw off the centuries of foreign domination. Godse is appalled by Gandhi's rejection of the warlike behavior of the heroes in classical Hindu epics. "It is my firm belief," he writes, "that in dubbing Rama, Krishna, and Arjuna as guilty of violence, the Mahatma betrayed a total ignorance of the springs of human action," end quote. Then he goes on to argue that it's actually Gandhi who's the more guilty of violence, since he exposes Indians to subordination and humiliation. Quote, "He was, paradoxical as it may appear, a violent pacifist who brought untold calamities on the country in the name of truth and nonviolence, while Shivaji and other resistance fighters will remain enshrined in the hearts of their countrymen forever for the freedom they brought to them." So deep was Godse's objection to nonviolence that he earlier refused an offer to commute his sentence to life imprisonment, saying, "Please, see to it that mercy is not imposed on me. I want to show that through me, Gandhiji's nonviolence is being hanged." And they did oblige. India is one of the few places, apart from the US, that still has capital punishment, although uses it quite infrequently. Godse's second major objection to Gandhi is to what he calls his pro-Muslim policy, which he sees in his support, for example, for the use of Urdu alongside Hindi as national languages, and in his willingness to create a situation in which Muslims enjoyed full civil rights. Gandhi, he argues, has betrayed his role as the father of the Indian nation. Godse tells us that he gradually came to the conclusion that Gandhi's disastrous policies could only be brought to an end by ending Gandhi's life. Such was Gandhi's personal charisma that, so long as he lived, the Congress Party would have to, quote, "be content with playing second fiddle to all his eccentricity, whimsicality, metaphysics, and primitive vision." Gandhi's, quote, "childish insanities and obstinacies, coupled with a most severe austerity of life, ceaseless work, and lofty character, made Gandhi formidable and irresistible," end quote. So he says he planned in secret, telling nobody about his plans, and then he fired the fatal shots. Toward the end of his statement appears a passage that heads that website I mentioned a moment ago, and it goes like this: "If devotion to one's country amounts to a sin, I admit I have committed that sin. If it is meritorious, I humbly claim the merit thereof. I fully and confidently believe that if there be any court of justice beyond the one founded by the mortals, my act will not be taken as unjust. If after death there be no such place to reach or to go, there is nothing to be said. I have resorted to the action I did purely for the benefit of humanity. I do say that my shots were fired at the person whose policy and action had brought rack and ruin and destruction to tens of thousands of Hindus." Nehru believed that the murder of Gandhi was part of what he called a fairly widespread conspiracy on the part of the Hindu right to seize power. He saw the situation as analogous to that of Europe on the eve of the fascist takeovers. And he knew that situation well because his wife had been in tuberculosis sanatoria in Switzerland during that period, and so Nehru was often there. And he believed that the RSS was the power behind the conspiracy. In December 1947, he had already written to the provincial governors, quote, "We have a great deal of evidence to show that the RSS is an organization which is in the nature of a private army and which is definitely proceeding along the strictest Nazi lines, even following their techniques of organization." So, for reasons of time, we have to now fast forward to recent years. Although illegal for a time, the RSS gradually reemerged and quietly went to work building a vast social network consisting particularly of groups for young boys that are called branches or shakas, which through clever use of games and songs indoctrinate thousands and thousands of young men into the confrontational and Hindu supremacist ideology of the organization. The idea of total obedience and the abnegation of the critical faculties is at the core of this solidaristic movement. Each day, as its members raise the saffron flag of Shivaji, which the movement prefers to the tricolor flag of the nation with the Buddhist wheel of law at its center, reminding one of the Emperor Ashoka's devotion to religious toleration, they recite the following pledge: "I take the oath that I will always protect the purity of Hindu religion, and the purity of Hindu culture for the supreme progress of the Hindu nation. I have become a component of the RSS. I will do the work of the RSS with utmost sincerity and unselfishness and with all my body, soul, and resources. And I will keep this vow for as long as I live. Victory to Mother India. The organization also makes clever use of modern media. A nationally televised serial version of the classical epic Ramayana in the late 1980s fascinated viewers all over India with its concocted tale of a unitary Hinduism dedicated to the single-minded worship of the god Rama and his birthplace at Ayodhya. As a result of the propaganda stirred up in this and other ways, in 1992, Hindu mobs, with the evident connivance of the BJP, the political party affiliated with the Hindu right, destroyed a mosque in the city of Ayodhya that they say covers the remains of a temple marking Rama's birthplace. Meanwhile, politically, the BJP began to gather strength in the late 1980s, drawing on widespread public dissatisfaction with the economic policies of the post-Nehru Congress Party. Although, one should remember that it was actually Congress under Rajiv Gandhi that began the needed economic reforms, and playing always the cards of hate and fear. It was during their rise to power and shortly before they were able to come to power in a coalition government that the destruction of the mosque at Ayodhya took place. The violence in Gujarat was the culmination of a series of increasingly angry pilgrimages to the Ayodhya site, where the Hindu right has attempted to build a Hindu temple over the ruins, but has been frustrated by the courts. Now, for several years, I studied the Gujarat violence, its basis, and its aftermath, looking for more general implications for the ways in which we should view religious violence and democracy in the world. And one obvious conclusion to draw is that each case must be studied on its own merits, with close attention to specific historical and regional factors. The idea that all conflicts are explained by a simple thesis of the clash of civilizations proves utterly inadequate to explain the facts of Gujarat, as you can see. European ideas, borrowed to address a perceived humiliation, were used to create an ideology that has ultimately led to a great deal of subordination and now violence against Muslims. Indeed, the clash of civilizations thesis is actually the best friend of the perpetrators because it shields them and their ideology from scrutiny. Repeatedly, in interviews that I conducted with leading members of this group, I wasn't using a hidden camera either. I just had my tape recorder out there on the table and signed releases, et cetera. But I was informed that no doubt because I was an American, I was already on their side because I must understand post 9/11 how dangerous Muslims were wherever they live. So the idea that you must take preemptive action to prevent them from causing trouble was expected to be an idea that I would share. So what we see in Gujarat is not the simplistic, comforting thesis of the clash of civilizations. It's something much more disturbing, the fact that in a thriving democracy, many individuals are unable to live with others who are different on terms of mutual respect and amity. They seek total domination as the only road to security and pride. This is a phenomenon, of course, that's well known in democracies around the world and has nothing much to do with a clash between democratic values and a Muslim monolith. So this case informs us that we must look within in each case, asking whether in our own society similar forces are at work, and if so, what they might be like and what we might do to counteract them. Beyond that general insight, my study of the riots has suggested four very specific lessons. First, the rule of law. One of the most appalling aspects of Gujarat was the complicity of officers of the law. Police sat on their hands, and indeed, now it's very clear, were ordered to do so on penalty of demotion or transfer. The highest officials of state government, prominently including Chief Minister Narendra Modi, egged on the killing. The national government, to some extent, gave aid and comfort to the state government. The worst aspect of the unequal state of Muslims in Gujarat was this inequality before the law. Muslims at present still are not fully equal citizens. The institutions of government broke down at the local and state level, and there were certainly weaknesses at the national level. However, The institutional and legal structure of the Indian democracy ultimately proved robust, playing a key role in securing justice for the victims. The Supreme Court and the National Electoral Commission played constructive roles in postponing new elections while Muslims had a chance to return to their homes, and in ordering changes of venue in key trials arising out of the violence. Above all, there were free national elections in 2004, and these elections, in which the participation of poor rural voters, energized by the very important structural feature called the panchayat system, a system of rural village councils that was one of Gandhi's primary ideas, delivered a strongly negative verdict on the policies of fear and hate, as well as on the BJP's economic policies. The current government, headed by Manmohan Singh, who's India's first minority prime minister, has announced a firm commitment to end sectarian violence and certainly has done at least something to focus attention on the unequal economic and political situation of Muslims. On balance, then, the pluralistic democratic structure envisaged by Gandhi and Nehru, with its constitutional fundamental rights, separation of powers, independent judiciary, seems to be winning, in part because the framers had bequeathed to India a pretty good institutional and constitutional structure and traditions of commitment to the key political values this structure embodies. And I should add that one of the key aspects of the founders' commitments, which so far has survived the Hindu right challenge, is their general conception of the nation and its unity as a unity around political ideals and values, particularly the value of equal entitlement, equality and fraternity, rather than around ethnic or religious or linguistic identity. India, like the US, but unlike most of the nations of Europe, has rejected linguistic and ethnic ways of characterizing the nation, adopting in the constitution, in public ceremonies, and in key public symbols, the political conception of unity. India's national anthem, Jana Gana Mana, words and music written by Rabindranath Tagore, is a paean to pluralism. It simply lists the diverse ethno-geographical origins of Indians and then says that all alike show reverence to the moral law. This public commitment to pluralism and the idea of pluralism and then a shared moral core is continually contested by the Hindu right, who prefer a different anthem, which called Bande Mataram, Hail Motherland, which is actually quite warlike and exclusionary. So far, however, the founder's strategy has held firm. Political structure is not everything, but it can supply a good deal in times of stress. Number two, the press and the role of intellectuals. One of the heartening aspects of Gujarat was, and still is, this Tehelka thing that just came out is another example of that, the performance of national media and the community of intellectuals. Both print media and television kept up unceasing pressure to document and investigate the riots, and the role of key government officials was documented beyond doubt. At the same time, because the local police were not doing their job, many scholars, lawyers, and activists, including, you know, people that are my academic friends who are law professors or whatever, converged on Gujarat to do things like taking down the testimony of women who had been raped, helping people file complaints, and in general to do the job of the law, preparing a public record that would stand up in court. The intellectual community has easier access to the national press in India than in the US, in part thanks to the somewhat greater financial independence of the national media, less corporate ownership, and these intellectuals seized the day, producing a wonderful outpouring of trenchant and high-quality analysis. The only reason I felt the need to write about these events further myself is that these analyses have by and large not reached the US audience. And I think we can see here documentation of something long ago observed by Amartya Sen in the context of famines, namely the crucial role of a free press in supporting democratic institutions. And we ought to study here what freedom really means. I would argue that it requires a certain absence of top-down corporate control and an easy access to the major media on the part of intellectual voices from a wide range of backgrounds. That is not the case today in the US, and I could make this vivid by saying that despite the fact that I live and work here, I have a much easier time publishing an op-ed or any other kind of opinion piece in an Indian newspaper or the equivalent of Time and Newsweek in India than I would here in the US, where that would be virtually impossible. Sen has recently returned to the topic of public debate in analyzing Indian politics, and I utterly agree with the two major contentions of his book, The Argumentative Indian. First, that India has a long and glorious tradition of public debate, and second, that this tradition is now in jeopardy given the ideological and anti-reason tactics of the Hindu right. But here I would just add the fact that market forces are usually not kind to investigative journalism, and that all nations need to watch out lest the crucial contribution of a free press to democracy be weakened beyond repair. Third, education, the importance of critical thinking and imagination. So far, I've mentioned factors that helped the Indian democracy survive the threat of quasi-fascist takeover, but now I move to warning signs for the future, areas in which the democracy is currently weak and vulnerable. The government schools of the state of Gujarat are famous for their complete lack of critical thinking, their exclusive emphasis on rote learning and the uncritical learning of marketable skills, and for the elements of political propaganda that easily creep in when critical thinking is not cultivated. It's well known, for example, that Hitler is presented as a hero in history textbooks in that state. Despite nationwide outcry against this, there's been no change. To some extent, the rest of the nation is better off than Gujarat. National-level textbooks have been rewritten to take out the false ideological view of history loved by the Hindu right and to substitute a much more nuanced view. Nonetheless, the emphasis on rote learning and regurgitation for national examinations is distressing everywhere, and things are only becoming worse with the immense pressure to produce economically productive graduates. The educational cultures of India used to contain wonderful progressive voices, such as the great Tagore, whom you may know as a poet, but he also was one of the great progressive educators, founding a school that influenced progressive education all over the world. And he emphasized that all the skills in the world were useless and even baneful if not wielded by a cultivated imagination and refined critical faculties. Currently, these voices are being silenced by the sheer demand for grabbing a bigger share of the global market. Parents of the new middle class want their children to learn marketable skills, and their great pride is the admission of a child to the Indian Institutes of Technology and Management. They typically have contempt for the study of humanities and the arts. I fear for democracy down the road when it's run, as it increasingly will be if things don't change, by docile engineers in the Gujarat mold, unable to criticize the propaganda of politicians, and unable to imagine the pain of another human being. This is no humorous topic, but it can be illustrated by an odd story from my own experience investigating the Gujarati community in the United States, where fully 40% of Indian Americans actually come from the state of Gujarat, and they're some of the most influential ones because they tend to be well-off engineers and technology people. A large proportion of Gujarati Hindus belong to the Swami Narayan sect of Hinduism, which at present is distinctive for its emphasis on uncritical obedience to the utterances of the current head of the sect, whose title is Pramukh Swami. On a visit to the elaborate multi-million-dollar Swami Narayan Temple in Bartlett, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, I was given a tour by a young man who had recently arrived from Gujarat, and he delighted in, as he took me around, in telling me the simplistic Hindu right-wing version of Indian history, and then he emphatically told me whenever Pramukh Swami speaks, one must immediately obey without question. At this point, with a beatific smile, he pointed up to the elaborate carved and really very beautiful marble ceiling of the temple. And he said, "Do you know why this ceiling glows the way it does?" And I said I didn't know, and I expected to get some spiritual explanation. But then he smiled even more broadly. "Fiber optic cables," he said. "We are the first to put this technology into a temple." Well, here you see, I think, what can easily wreck a democracy, the combination of great technological sophistication with utter docility. I fear that many democracies around the world, including our own, are going down that road very quickly through a lack of emphasis on the humanities and arts and an unbalanced emphasis on profitable skills. Finally, number four, the creation of a liberal public culture. How did quasi-fascism take such a hold in India? Hindu traditions emphasized tolerance and pluralism, and daily life in the great cities of India, as in New York, tends to emphasize the ferment and vigor of difference as people from so many different ethnic, linguistic, and regional backgrounds encounter one another. But the traditions contain a locus of vulnerability, and I would locate it in the area of humiliated masculinity. For centuries, many Hindu males think they've been subordinated, laughed at, treated as weak by this sequence of conquerors. The fact that the British really did despise Hinduism as what Winston Churchill called a beastly religion surely made matters worse. And Hindus all too easily came to identify the sexual playfulness and sensuousness of their traditions, scorned by the masters of the Raj, with their own weakness and subjection. So, a repudiation of the sensuous and the cultivation of the sort of masculinity typified by Tagore's image of the British military band came to seem the best way out of that subjection. One reason why the RSS attracts such a following today is this widespread sense of masculine failure, a key aspect of the rhetoric of both Savarkar and Gawarkar and of RSS shakas in every part of India today. At the same time, the RSS also filled a void, organizing at the grassroots level with great selflessness and great discipline. The RSS is not just about ideology and fascist organization, it also provides needed social services. And it provides fun, luring boys in with the promise of a group life that has both more solidarity and more fun and games than the tedious world of government schools. Gawarkar said that if he saw a beautiful peacock in his garden and wanted it to become his pet, he would feed it little bits of opium every day until it became addicted, and then it would turn up in his garden every day. And that, he said, is how the shakas work. By the lure of fun and games, they get the boys to be addicted and they make them obedient members of the organization. So what would have been needed and is needed is some counter force which would supply a public culture of pluralism with equally effective grassroots organization and a public culture of masculinity that would contend against the appeal of the warlike and rapacious masculinity pervaded by the Hindu right. The clash within is not so much a clash between two groups who are different from birth. It's at bottom a clash within each person in which the ability to live with others on terms of compassion and respect contends anxiously against the sense of being humiliated. Gandhi understood this very well. During his lifetime, his powerful movement did purvey a counterimage to the images of domineering masculinity. He taught his followers that life's real struggle was a struggle within the self against one's own need to dominate and one's fear of being vulnerable. He deliberately focused attention on sexuality as an arena in which the urge to dominate plays itself out with baneful effect. I think that in some respects he went off the tracks in his suggestion that sexual relations are inherently scenes of domination and in his recommendation of asceticism as the only route to non-domination. Nonetheless, he saw the problem at its base, and he proposed a public culture that while he lived was sufficient to address it. His followers understood that being a real man doesn't mean emulating British aggressiveness and learning how to bash others. It means having the courage not to bash others, to stand up to that aggression with nothing but one's own naked human dignity around one. In the process, if you've seen the great film of his life, that scene where the people march four by four and each group of four is clubbed down by the British and then they go off and another four come and they're clubbed down. I mean, this is what he showed was those people were much more manly than the ones who were clubbing them. They were just trying to get hold of something that they couldn't even touch, and they looked increasingly impotent and quite ridiculous. So in the process, he showed this to the whole world, and he won the world's admiration for India's men and traditions conceived as he conceived them. In quite a different way, in a more local level, in Bengal, Rabindranath Tagore also created a counterimage of the Indian self, an image that was more sensuous, more joyful than that of Gandhi's, focusing on expression through music and the dance, but equally bent on renouncing the domination that Tagore saw as the baneful legacy of European nationalism to India. After Gandhi, however, this part of the pluralist program has languished. Much though he loved and admired both Gandhi and Tagore, Nehru had contempt for religion, and out of that contempt, he neglected the cultivation of that which the radical religions of both men had supplied, images of who we are as citizens, symbolic and, as it were, ritual connections to the roots of human vulnerability and openness, and the creation of a grassroots public culture around these symbols. Nehru was a great institution builder, but in thinking about the public culture of the new nation, his focus was always on economic uplift, not so much on cultural issues. Because he firmly expected that raising the economic level of the poor would cause them to lose the need for religion, and in general for symbolic and emotional sources of nourishment, he saw no need to provide a counterforce to the powerful emotional propaganda of the Hindu right. Today's young people in India, therefore, all too often think of symbolic cultural creation in general as a force that is in its very nature fascist and reactionary, because that's what they've seen in their own experience. When one tells them the story of the US civil rights movement, the role of both liberal religion and powerful pluralist rhetoric in forging an anti-racist civic culture in the aftermath of that movement, they're quite surprised. Meanwhile, the RSS, which understands human psychology very well, goes to work unopposed in every state and region, skillfully plucking the strings of hate and fear. By now, pluralists generally realize that a mistake was made in leaving grassroots organizing to the right, but it's very difficult to jumpstart a pluralist movement. The salient exception, and it's one that bulks large in my experience, has been the women's movement, which has built at the grassroots level very effectively, always crossing lines of religion and caste, with the regional knowledge, the mixture of economic and cultural incentives, and the use of the arts and critical thinking that the creation of such a movement requires. And here, I do have some serious differences with Amartya Sen's analysis of religious violence in his recent book on identity. Sen suggests that religious violence is based on an intellectual mistake. People are somehow bamboozled into thinking that there's a single identity, that they simply must make the core of their own self-definition, and then they're convinced that this identity, quote, makes extensive demands, sometimes of a most disagreeable kind, end quote. Instead, Sen argues, they should wake up and realize they have lots of choices, and that leading a human life centrally involves, quote, the responsibilities of choice and reasoning, end quote. What's needed in order to set things on a better course is simply to remind people of their freedom and show them that there's no inevitability about the so-called destiny of being associated with a particular ethnic or religious group and its leaders' demands. Now, of course, I'm all for public debate, and I also agree heartily with Sen that people have many choices about how to identify themselves. I think, however, that his diagnosis remains on the surface and doesn't come to grips with what makes otherwise reasonable and intelligent people go in for violent behavior. His unwillingness to confront the murkier depths of human psychology makes his peer into reasoning seem actually a little condescending. The world's in trouble only because a lot of people haven't realized some pretty obvious facts. People, however, are not stupid, and bad behavior is not based on an easily corrected error. We need to try to understand what it is about the experience of humiliation and subordination that leads to retaliatory aggression. So we need to talk about the weakness that all human beings share, their shame before that weakness, their disgust at the parts of the human body that are the keenest reminders of that weakness. And then we need to talk about masculinity and how constructed images of masculinity express, in some cases, disgust, shame, and retaliatory aggression. And in other cases, express a sense of the dignified acceptance of the limited character of human existence. Gandhi's genius was to understand where hatred resides and to see that one cannot dislodge it without proposing new images of what a real man is, what a real human being is. His contention that we cannot undo hatred without undertaking a total reform of the emotions connected to masculine pride seems to me utterly correct. Tagore had similar insights, perhaps with a healthier and more optimistic understanding of the potential of human sexuality. He, too, thought that images of the real man need to be remade if human beings were ever to realize the humanity of which they were capable. Such proposals of internal critique and reform find no place in Sen's impatiently intellectualistic reading of violence. Sen's diagnosis and mine lead in the same direction to some extent, in that both of us favor a great emphasis on argument and critical thinking, both in schools and in the general public culture. My understanding of violence, however, requires far more. A large role for the cultivation of sympathy in schools, as Tagore insistently proposed and used the arts to do that, together with a large role for the humanities and the arts in every part of education. And then, what must surround the schools if their work is not to be futile? A civic culture with symbolic and artistic elements linking manliness to restraint and compassion. This program is not at all easy to achieve. To that extent, my own take on the future of democracy in the world remains less confident than Sen's. It's comforting for Americans to talk about a clash of civilizations. This thesis tells us that evil is outside, distant, other, and that we are perfectly all right as we are. All we need to do is remain true to ourselves and fight the good fight. But the case of Gujarat shows us that the world is very different. The forces that assail democracy are internal to many, if not most, of the democratic nations, and they're not foreign. They're our own ideas and voices, meaning especially that they're very often the voices of aggressive European nationalism, refracted back against the original aggressor with the extra bile of resentment born of a long experience of domination and humiliation. The implication of this idea is that all nations, Western and non-Western, need to examine themselves with the most fearless exercise of the critical capacities, looking for the roots of domination within and devising effective institutional and educational countermeasures. And then, at a deeper level, it shows us what Gandhi and Tagore knew full well, that the real root of domination is in the human personality, in the narcissistic desire to dominate others, and to efface the inconvenient challenge posed by the other. It would be very convenient if Americans were pure and free from flaw, but we can now see that very fantasy of purity for what it is, as yet another form that the resourceful narcissism of the human personality takes on its way to bad behavior. If we look at the clash in my way as an internal clash, we'll naturally focus on my four strategies for the preservation and enhancement of democracy around the world. First, on getting institutional structures that can remain stable against fascist challenges. Second, on bolstering the independence, prominently including the economic independence of the press and the free speech of intellectuals. Third, on creating schools and universities that teach the skills of critical thinking and imagining that are so crucial for the health of democracy. And finally, what Martin Luther King Jr. learned from Gandhi, creating a public culture of non-domination and equality that can inspire fearful human beings, for we're all fearful, with the idea that comfort is to be found in mutual aid and reciprocity rather than the quick and dirty victory over an enemy onto whom we have all too conveniently projected our own fears. Thank you.
This lecture was recorded at the Yale Law School on December 3rd, 2007.